Exodus Review and Exodus 12:1 through 12:51. The 13th talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on November 10, 1996 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1996. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
I started teaching through Exodus, and I'm going to pick up where I left off, which will be with Exodus chapter 12. Just as a reminder of what I'm doing at Exodus, it's warm here. I'm standing over the heater vent. I believe that the theme of Exodus is God introducing himself to human beings. The situation is this: the Israelites, the Hebrews, the descendants of Abraham, had gone down to Egypt in the time of Joseph and taken all of their families, and they stayed there in the land of Goshen, which is just to the east of Egypt proper. They end up staying there and were there for 400 some years, during which time they were assimilated to a large extent into Egyptian culture. They began to adopt Egyptian customs and beliefs. And for a period of that time, they were enslaved by the Egyptians. It's not clear how long they were enslaved to the Egyptians, but for some period of time. So they're in Egypt, in slavery, and God, after 400 years, raises up a man, Moses, to lead them out of Egypt. The beginning of Moses' life is very propitious. Moses is born at a time when the Egyptians are putting to death all male Hebrew babies. And by all rights, Moses should also have been put to death. But his mother put him in a basket in the Nile that was found by the daughter of Pharaoh, who adopted him as her own and raised him in the household of Pharaoh. Moses grew up then in the household of Pharaoh. There are extra-biblical accounts of Moses becoming a great general and leading an expedition into Nubia, a successful expedition. And according to the extra-biblical sources, rose to a position of prominence and considerable fame as a military leader. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But in any case, his first 40 years seem to have been truly blessed by God. It appeared as though Moses had been raised up for the purpose of delivering his people from Egypt. And apparently Moses believed that that was the case. And in defense of one of his fellow Israelites, with whom he felt great kinship, he killed an Egyptian. And as a result, once that became known, he had to flee Egypt and go into the desert. So just at the point in his life, at the age of about 40, when it looked like Moses was ready to do something significant for his people, he has to leave Egypt, and he spends 40 years in the desert doing nothing of significance. It must have been enormously humbling and earth-shaking event for Moses to reconsider, what does this all mean? Why am I here? What is my purpose in life? What does God want me to do? Then after 80 years of his life, 40 years in the desert, God spoke to him through the burning bush and told him to go back to Egypt and lead his people, lead the Israelites, out of slavery, out of Egypt. Moses did return to Egypt, spoke to Pharaoh, asked for permission for the Israelites to leave, and the Pharaoh said, no way. And so God inflicted upon Egypt a series of plagues that increased in severity and extent, and they also increased in their selectivity. They were plagues that afflicted the Egyptians and not the Israelites. So the sharp distinction was drawn by the way God decided to inflict these plagues on Egypt. Finally, Pharaoh told Moses after the ninth plague, get out of here, I don't want to see your face again. And Moses said, the feeling is mutual, and you will not see my face again. And Moses left, and then it was the tenth plague, in which God said that he was going to kill all of the firstborn of Egypt. This was a plague. This last plague was not announced to Pharaoh in advance. Okay. So that's where it comes up to in chapter 12. And in chapter 12, then we'll look at the Passover itself, the actual visitation of the death angel on the Egyptians. But before we jump into the passage, I want to talk just briefly about what I think the importance of the book of Exodus and more generally the whole Old Testament is. It seems to me that it is extremely important for us to understand what kind of being the God that we worship is. Who is he? What is his nature? What does he value? What does he not value? What are his strategies in life? The reason this is so important, I think, and the reason, in order to understand the gospel, to understand what we're supposed to be doing in this life, to understand, make sense of our experience and the reality that we're immersed in, we have to understand God, the one who created this thing. And if my understanding of Genesis is correct, reality is just the stage that God created on which he could display who he really is to an audience that he created as a part of this whole universe as well, us. But the purpose of reality is for God to be able to make known to other beings what kind of being he is. If that's true, then the key to understanding reality, what's at the heart of the whole thing, is who God is. I don't think it was erroneous in medieval education for theology to have been the pinnacle of education, to have been the culmination of understanding all of reality. I think that makes sense. Who God is can only be understood by putting together the clues from all of reality. And that's what makes sense of all of reality. And the Old Testament plays, I think, a very important role in understanding who God is. On the basis of the New Testament alone, there are some features of God's character that it seems to me have a tendency to get lost. For instance, the New Testament talks about God as a God of love. I don't dispute that. The Old Testament would not dispute that. However, on the basis of the New Testament alone, it's possible to have God as kind of a Walt Disney character, a cuddly being. The Old Testament doesn't allow that. In the Old Testament, we see the severity of God. God is willing to inflict a lot of pain on his people. A lot of pain. And if we don't understand that, we don't understand God, we don't understand what he's doing. it has been striking to me just in the last few months, in the sharing time in this group, how many people among our friends are suffering from cancer and other serious life-threatening illnesses. God inflicts a lot of pain. That's not incompatible with who God is. But he has his purposes. He's doing what he's doing. He knows what he's doing. And his purposes are very complicated. And we have to understand all of the different kinds of things that God does to bring us around to value what he values. And that's a big process. In the New Testament, we read that God hates sin, that God's opposed to sin. But it seems to me that on the basis of the New Testament alone, it is possible to come to the understanding that he hates sin like socialists hate poverty in the abstract. Hannah Arendt talks about it's only in the modern times that people talk about poverty and how poverty is a bad thing. In earlier times, people talked about the poor and how the poor needed to be helped. But we have made it an abstract concept, which we can say, yes, poverty is a terrible thing, and at the same time, ignore the poor. And there's a sense in which God brings his hate towards sin to be something that we really understand when we read the Old Testament. It seems to me you can understand his hatred towards sin more better when we see the punishments that God is willing to afflict in instances of sin. He is willing to torch cities because they're sinful. Sodom and Gomorrah were torched because of their wickedness. Population of probably 100,000 people. So there's something really sobering about the Old Testament. It brings a side of God into our vision that we might otherwise forget about. And therefore, I believe the Old Testament is well worth our attention. It's a different culture. It's a different time. It's further from us than the New Testament in time and culture. But nevertheless, I think it's worthwhile digging out of it things of value. And in Exodus in particular, I am finding much in Exodus that is very helpful to me. I identify, and we will see, up to now we've seen God revealing himself, and we haven't seen much of the response of the Israelites to God. But in the next few chapters, we're going to begin to see how the Israelites responded to God. And I find that very helpful because as I get older, I'm seeing more how I am very like the Israelites. I don't learn quickly who God is. It takes me a lot of lessons, a lot of time. And I respond very much like the Israelites did. It's hard for me to trust God. It's hard for me, even in the face of things that God is clearly doing in my life, it's hard for me 2 or 3 weeks later to trust him, nevertheless. So I'm beginning to see that I'm very like the Israelites. And it helps me to see myself in them. It's harder to see myself in myself. Just as a sidelight, I remember teaching a passage from the Old Testament when I was in college. It was just a small Bible study. There were about 5 people there. I'm used to that size. And there was one girl, she came to the first Bible study, and she was, after we had talked about this passage, she said, "Oh, the Israelites are so stupid. I can't understand how they can see God in action and then turn around the next day and be faithless. They're so stupid." And I tried to respond to that and didn't respond very, very well to it. But a few days later, I saw her come into the dorm. She was so drunk she could barely walk. And it was just kind of a strange image that here's the person who couldn't identify with the Israelites and yet had not learned to control her own being. Okay, today in chapter 12, it's the Passover. Now this passage is, this chapter is fairly long, but, and it's somewhat repetitive, but I think there is an organization to it that can, that makes sense. And I will try to point out the organization, and I will go through this chunk by chunk. The first section, Exodus 12, 1 through 14. Now the Lord God said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, "This month shall be a beginning of months for you. It is to be the first month of the year to you. Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, 'On the 10th of this month, they are each one to take a lamb for themselves according to their father's households, a lamb for each household.' Now if the household is too small for a lamb, then he and his neighbor nearest to his house are to take one according to the number of persons in them. According to what each man should eat, you are to divide the lamb. Your lamb shall be an unblemished male, a year old. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats. And you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel is to kill it at twilight. Moreover, they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses in which they eat it. And they shall eat the flesh that same night, roasted with fire, and they shall eat it with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. Do not eat any of it raw or boiled with water, but rather roasted with fire, both in its head and its legs, along with its entrails. And you shall not leave any of it over until morning, but whatever is left of it until morning, you shall burn with fire. Now you shall eat it in this manner, with your loins girded, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand, and you shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. For I will go through the land of Egypt on that night, and I will strike down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast. And against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am the Lord. And the blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you live. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you, and no plague will befall you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. Now this day will be a memorial to you, and you shall celebrate it as a feast to the Lord throughout your generations. You are to celebrate it as a permanent ordinance." There's obviously a lot of symbolism in this ceremony that God is prescribing a certain way that they are supposed to carry out this meal on the eve of their departure from Egypt. And there's obviously a lot of ceremony, of symbolism built into this ceremony. And I've been trying to sort out the symbolism, and I don't feel comfortable saying that I know what these symbols mean. So I think in lieu of telling you what these symbols mean, what I will do is to raise some questions with respect to these symbols. First of all, this is to happen, it says, "This month shall be a beginning of months for you. It is to be the first month of the year to you." Now, it's possible that what God is saying is, from now on, New Year's will be at this month. However, one of the commentators that I rely upon heavily, Umberto Casuto, says that the Hebrew grammar will not allow this option. Rather, what it's saying is, this is the New Year, but from now on, this New Year will take on new significance for you. In either case, what God seems to be saying is, this is going to be a watershed time. This is a time of new beginnings. And you will remember it as such from here on, indefinitely. It is curious to me that that the time of the birth of Christ has been one of those times from which we measure time, an event from which we measure time. It is a curious accident of history that the world has adopted the AD BC way of measuring years. And there are attempts now to use other terms to indicate AD and BC. For instance, BC used to mean before Christ, and now it's being substituted with BCE, before the common era, whatever the common era is. Nevertheless, the fact that dates are dated from the birth of Christ is a curious thing that God has worked out in history, it seems to me. A time from which time should be measured, an event from which time should be measured. Well, God is instituting here an event from which time is to be measured. It is so significant that it becomes one of those cornerstones for our timeline, anchor points for our timeline. Okay, for this meal, each family is to take a lamb, each household. And this is apparently not the extended family, but rather the household itself. This raises an interesting issue, at least in my mind. It's the question of the individual's fate and the group's fate. There are times, especially in the Old Testament, where groups of people suffer a common fate. They are associated together, and God treats them as a group. The nation of Israel, for instance, was at times punished as a group. Sodom and Gomorrah, that was a city that was punished as a community. So there are times in which God punishes whole communities. There are other times in which it's individuals that are singled out for either blessing or curses. And here, it's something in between. It's the family. Why God chose that unit, I don't know. But it's the family that is to kill the ram and to share this meal together. The animal that is to be selected is to be an unblemished male. No rejects. This is not a way of getting rid of the animals that are defective in some way. These are supposed to be animals that otherwise would not be put to death. Otherwise, there would be no reason to put them to death except for this purpose. So there's a sense in which this animal is an innocent animal. It's an animal that would not otherwise die except as a provision so that the Israelites can live, the people in the house can live. The killing is supposed to take place at twilight, which in the Israelite way of seeing things is the beginning of a day. The animal is to be put to death, and then the animal is to be prepared for the meal. I don't know. As I imagine carrying out this ceremony, it seems to me it would be a very sobering thing to take this ram that would otherwise not be put to death and to slit its throat and see the blood gush out and the death and the life leave that creature, knowing that it's so that I can live that animal has to die. There are only a few times in my life that I have killed an animal or seen an animal die. There's one instance I can remember in particular. It was when I had to shoot one of our sheep. The neighbor's dog had got in with our sheep and had ripped a hole in the side of the sheep, and it was, the insides were falling out, and it was not a good scene. So so my neighbor came over with his gun, and we had to shoot this lamb. And in our society, putting something to death is not, we don't do it much. If we were in an agrarian society, putting something to death would not be as unique, as unusual. But in my experience, it's unusual to put something dead to death. And it's strange to think about the fact that you have this animal that's moving around, that's active, that's kicking and jumping 1 minute, and then the blood gushes out and the animal kicks and twitches for a while, but after 5 minutes it's a lifeless blob. Life is a strange thing. Where does life come from? What is life? If I were to carry out this sacrifice, I would have a difficult time not reflecting on what life is and the significance of this other life being given up for my own, and the fleetingness of life, the fact that life is largely out of our control, and our fate is largely out of our control. God asked them then to put to death this sheep, this ram. They take the blood then from the ram. The blood is commonly in the Old Testament used as the symbol for life itself. They were to take the blood and to smear it on the doorposts, the sides of the doors and across the top on the lintel of the doorpost, on the outside of the house. Why there? I don't know. But it seems to me that God could have said, take some blood and put it on each person's forehead. That would be a more personal way of indicating, yes, I'm taking part in this. But rather it's by household. And it's on the outside of the house in a more publicly visible place. The blood was put on the doorpost so that the angel of death, when it passes through, would not enter into those houses. Then they were to take the animal and cook it. They were not to eat it raw, and they were not to boil it in water. And they were to cook the whole thing. Now, Umberto Casuto argues that there was a ceremony, a spring ceremony, a springtime ceremony that the Israelites had done from ancient times, in which they had eaten some meat raw and maybe boiled some meat. And that what God is doing is giving new significance to this old ceremony, and therefore asking them to do a few things differently. Now, he does not give reasons or evidence why he believes that this was an ancient ceremony that's being converted. So I don't know. I find him a very helpful commentator. He makes some very good observations, and generally I benefit from reading his suggestions. In this case, I just don't know what to think, because I don't know what evidence he's going on. It would not be, it seems to me, contrary to God's nature and his way of doing things to take an old institution and give it new significance. I think there's precedence for him doing that. So it wouldn't surprise me if that's the case. I just don't know that that's the case. Other than that, I don't know how to account for the fact that he says this animal needs to be cooked on the fire, not boiled and not raw. But that is what he insists. They are to eat all of it. None of it is to leave the house. All of it is to be consumed before morning. Whatever is not consumed is then to be burned up and destroyed. The meat is to be eaten with unleavened bread and with bitter herbs. At this point, the significance of the unleavened bread seems to be the fact that they are going to have to leave quickly. There isn't even time to let the bread rise. So the unleavened bread then is a way of capturing the fact that this is not a time for dual-mindedness. Am I going to go or am I not going to go? To sort through your belongings. Which ones am I going to take and which ones am I not going to take? Etc. This has to be done quickly. And that's underscored by the fact that they are supposed to be eat this meal dressed, ready to go. Staff in hand, sandals on. The other thing they are to eat with the meal is the bitter herbs. It seems to me that the significance of the bitter herbs probably is to remind them of the bitterness of life in Egypt. In the first chapter of Egypt, it talks about their bitter slavery in Egypt. This is a curious one because, in fact, they didn't have it all that bad in Egypt. Yes, they were slaves, but they had food. They were more or less taken care of. In general, slave owners take care of slaves because they are capital. They're an investment. And the Israelites will, in fact, once they get into the desert, they will think fondly back to when they were in Egypt and how good they had it there. And the desert, they're going to think about their experience in the desert, and they're saying, well, it's no better here. We were better off in Egypt. And here in this meal, God is requiring that they eat bitter herbs, I think as a remembrance of the fact that life in Egypt was indeed bitter. It may have been comfortable in some respects, but it was bitter because it was slavery. In the desert, it may be dusty. They may not have the same comforts that they had in Egypt, but at least they're free. And that's a greater good. Then in the last few verses of this section, God points out the significance of this event. This is a rite that was prescribed by God. It is the Lord's Passover. This is what God is doing. This is no messing around. I will refrain from quoting from a Talking Heads song. And God said that what's going to happen here is He is going to judge Egypt and the gods of Egypt. That when the angel of death comes, those are the two objects of His judgment. But the blood will protect the Israelites from this same judgment. And from here on out, they are to celebrate this event yearly. They are to remember this event. And I am struck by the importance of these memories. Throughout the book of Exodus and even throughout the Pentateuch, God stresses remembering these mileposts. Everybody pile up rocks here and remember this event when we crossed the Jordan. Remember this event when the angel of death passed over us in Egypt. Remember these things that God has done. The reason is because in the days after, the significance and the sense of deliverance, the sense of God's action in my life, is going to diminish. And with time, we will forget the importance of God and His activity in our lives and His faithfulness to us. You need to remember these things, consciously work on remembering these things so that you will not forget. Okay, the next section he gives instructions for future celebration, verses 15 through 20. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, but on the first day you shall remove leaven from your houses. For whoever eats anything leavened from the first day until the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. And on the first day you shall have a holy assembly, and another holy assembly on the seventh day. No work at all shall be done on them except what must be eaten by every person. That alone may be prepared by you. You shall also observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread. For on this very day I brought your hosts out of the land of Egypt. Therefore you shall observe this day throughout your generations as a permanent ordinance. In the first month, on the 14th day of the month, at evening, you shall eat unleavened bread until the 21st day of the month at evening. 7 days there shall be no leaven found in your houses, for whoever eats what is leavened, that person shall be cut off from the congregation of Israel, whether he is an alien or a native of the land. You shall not eat anything leavened. In all your dwellings you shall eat unleavened bread. Now here he apparently is talking to Moses about, in the future, future celebrations of this same meal, there are additional instructions, and those instructions include a longer period during which they will eat unleavened bread. And it will start with searching through the house and getting rid of anything that has leaven. Now, it is striking to me through these verses the emphasis that is put on leaven. They are to scour the house, get rid of all of it. They are not to eat it for 7 days, anything that has touched leaven. And anyone who violates that law is to be cut off from the people of Israel. That seems like a severe punishment for eating bread. I think here then, leaven is taking on another significance rather than just the symbolism of haste. And I am tempted to think that leaven here is symbolizing something, I assume, something like wickedness or sin. Now, it doesn't say that, but it has to be something more significant than just symbolizing the hastiness with which this departure has to take place. Eating of leaven is severely punished. He's making a big deal of this. And there are instances in which leaven is used symbolically to indicate evil or wickedness. Elsewhere in Scripture, it seems to me fitting that would be the symbolic import of that here. Verses 21 through 28, Moses then turns to the people of Israel and instructs them according to the instructions that were given to him from God. There's little difference between his instructions here and the instructions that were already given, so I will just read through it. Then Moses called for all the elders of Israel and said to them, "Go and take for yourselves lambs according to your families and slay the Passover lamb. And you shall take a bunch of hyssop and dip it in the blood which is in the basin, and apply some of the blood that is in the basin to the lintel and the two doorposts, and none of you shall go outside the door of his house until morning. For the Lord will pass through to smite the Egyptians, and when he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over the door and will not allow the destroyer to come into your houses to smite you. And you shall observe this event as an ordinance for you and your children forever. And it will come about when you enter the land which the Lord will give you, as he has promised, that you shall observe this rite. And it will come about when your children will say to you, 'What does this rite mean to you?' that you shall say, 'It is a Passover sacrifice to the Lord, who passed over the houses of the sons of Israel in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians, but spared our homes.'" And the people bowed low and worshipped. Then the sons of Israel went out and did so, just as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron. So they did. It must have been particularly sobering for them to carry out this Passover, because they have witnessed, probably over the past year, quite a number of displays of God's power in judgment on Egypt. And here we're coming up to the pinnacle of those judgments. And the fact that God was going to spare them on the basis of the blood of this sacrificed lamb, I don't see how that couldn't have been very sobering. Okay, then in verses 29 through 39, it talks about the actual event of the angel of death visiting the land of Egypt. Now it came about at midnight that the Lord struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne, to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of cattle. And Pharaoh arose in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians. And there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was no home where there was not someone dead. Then he called for Moses and Aaron at night and said, "Rise up, get out from among my people, both you and the sons of Israel, and go worship the Lord as you have said. Take both your flocks and your herds as you have said, and go and bless me also." And the Egyptians urged the people to send them out of the land in haste, for they said, "We shall all be dead." So the people took their dough before it was leavened, with their kneading bowls bound up in the clothes on their shoulders. Now the sons of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, for they had requested from the Egyptians articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing. And the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they let them have their request. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. So the angel of death comes, and you can imagine in every household someone dying. It must have been a horrendous night for the Egyptians. And Pharaoh, apparently there's death in Pharaoh's household as well. He was not told that this plague would be coming. Some of the plagues had been told beforehand to Pharaoh, but not this one. But Pharaoh knows who's responsible. He knows what's going on. And as a result, he calls Moses and Aaron. And he says, "Get out of here. You can even take your flocks. You can take everything. Just get out of here. I've had it. And the people of Egypt are afraid that they'll all die. They just want the Israelites to leave." So the Israelites quickly get together the belongings they've got. They ask their Egyptian masters for clothing, jewelry, things of gold and silver. And God has prepared the Egyptians so that they are very willing to give up these things in order to just be rid of this curse of the Israelites. So just as God had said much earlier in Exodus, had told Moses he was going to lead his people out of Egypt and they would plunder the Egyptians. This is an unusual kind of plunder. It's voluntary plunder. And they leave. Verse 37, "Now the sons of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, aside from children. And a mixed multitude also went up with them, along with the flocks and herds, a very large number of livestock. And they baked the dough which they had brought out of Egypt into cakes of unleavened bread, for it had not become leavened since they were driven out of Egypt and could not delay, nor had they prepared any provisions for themselves." A couple of comments here. One, the 600,000 men. I have discovered a little essay called "The Use of Large Numbers in the Old Testament." And at some point in the future, I will tell you, I will summarize for you what it argues in there. But it's one of those books that I had to get it by interlibrary loan. It's one of those obscure little things that in my mind, is pure gold. Because he explains how to account for some of these big numbers in Exodus that would not otherwise seem to fit. If there are 600,000 men, what they typically do is multiply that by 4 to determine the total population. And sometimes they multiply it by larger numbers. Sometimes it's as high as 6. But even if you multiply it by 4, that gets to be a big group. And people have argued, well, impossible, the logistics, the amount of time it would take for that many to get across the Red Sea, and all kinds of things. But I'll talk about this essay at another point, but it is probable that that number is significantly less than 600,000. And he argues that without taking away from biblical inerrancy. In verse 38 it says, a mixed multitude also went up with them. I have never noticed this before. Apparently there were non-Israelites that tagged along. This term, mixed multitude, apparently refers to other people, not the Israelites, other than the Israelites. Okay, verse 40. Now the time that the sons of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. And it came about at the end of 430 years to the very day that all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. It is a night to be observed for the Lord for having brought them out of the land of Egypt. This night is for the Lord to be observed by all the sons of Israel throughout their generation. This verse is significant in calculating when the Exodus occurred and when the descendants of Abraham went down into Egypt. It says that it is 430 years from the time when they left Egypt, from the time when they went into Egypt to the time that they left Egypt. And it says, to the very day. 430 years to the very day. That seems fairly specific and precise. Some people have argued that the 430 years is either symbolic or it's rounded off. It's in very round terms. But the fact that he uses to the very day makes one suspicious that it is intended to be a precise date. If it is a precise date, we can calculate approximately, we can calculate fairly accurately, when the descendants of Abraham went down into Egypt. It says in 1 Kings 6:1 that there were 480 years from the time when Solomon began to build the temple in Jerusalem back to the time when the Exodus occurred. Solomon began to build his temple in Jerusalem, I think it's about 970. So you can add 480 to that, and you'll get something like 1450, someplace in the mid-1400s. My mental math is wonderful. And then you can add the 430 to that. It takes us back into about the 1800s for the time when the people went down into Egypt. I'll just quickly read the last section, 43 to 51. And the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, this is the ordinance of the Passover. No foreigner is to eat of it. But every man's slave purchased with money after you have circumcised him, then he may eat of it. A sojourner or a hired servant shall not eat of it. It is to be eaten in a single house. You are not to bring forth any of the flesh outside of the house, nor are you to break any bone of it. All the congregation of Israel are to celebrate this. But if a stranger sojourns with you and celebrates the Passover to the Lord, let all his males be circumcised, and then let him come near to celebrate it, and he shall be like a native of the land. But no uncircumcised person may eat of it. The same law shall apply to the native as to the stranger who sojourns among you. Then all the sons of Israel did so. They did just as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron. And it came about on that same day that the Lord brought the sons of Israel out of the land of Egypt by their hosts. Here it's making provision. A person who is not an Israelite can participate in this if they first become circumcised, if they first convert. Otherwise, no one is to take part of it. Even the Israelite who is not uncircumcised is forbidden to take part of this Passover. This Passover was only for God's chosen people. They are the only ones that celebrate it. It is the only ones for whom this stuff has personal significance. Okay. A question or two? Comment or two? Chris?
I was thinking when you were talking about the unleavened bread and the meat and the herbs and stuff like that, that generally in our culture when we have celebrations are always celebratory and happy and excited and stuff like that. And you were talking about how you felt that it was supposed to be rather somber. And that you had mentioned that somebody had suggested there was a spring celebration where they ate the raw meat and the boiled meat. And one might suspect that if that were the case, that celebration was probably more celebratory. And so is it possible, it's just a conjecture, I don't know, basis for it, other than what you said, is it possible that the bitter herbs and the unleavened bread and the cooked meat that way were all supposed to be representative of the fact that it was supposed to be a somber rather than a celebratory kind of event? And so by stressing those things, one is pointing to the somberness of the thing primarily or something.
I don't know. It's possible. But I'd like to comment on your distinction between a somber and a merry celebration. It seems to me that there are elements of both in this. And I'm not sure I'd use the word somber, but rather sober. That it seems to me that one could not help but be humbled by this. Because if I were an Israelite, I'd be saying, why is it that my Egyptian master is going to have his firstborn dead and I will not? It's because I cut this ram, I slit this ram's throat and I put blood on my doorposts. I mean, does that really warrant the salvation that I'm getting? So it seems to me that it's inescapably sobering. Much like it seems to me Thanksgiving. Our Thanksgiving is kind of a combination of celebration, and it should be, and in a sense, a sobering and kind of humbling thing, because it's recognition of the fact that I am alive and have food on the table is only slightly my doing. I mean, I only contribute a little bit to that. And it seems to me that's kind of humbling, that our well-being is, for the most part, dependent on God and not on us. But that doesn't mean it can't be celebratory at the same time. I'm glad that's the case, but it's not something I deserve. And I think that the Passover is intended to be that kind of dual ceremony as well. It's both sobering and joyous. Logan.
There's about the angel of death, there's where the Lord says, I, and no one else but I shall come down into the... Is the messenger of death, is the messenger of death itself, and it's God himself doing it, or do you point an angel to carry that out. People get real confused about this because they don't want to think God is coming down and doing this himself, actually causing death. Where do you land on that?
Well, I didn't even reflect on that because in my mind, the difference is insignificant. It's, you know, even with, even in our society, if a lieutenant of the president does something wrong, the president is held responsible for that. Should be. I mean, let's take another example. Well, you know what I mean. I don't see much distinction. If God is truly the one who delegates the authority to that angel to come down and inflict the death, than to say it was God that did it or that it was the angel that did it, I don't see a significant distinction. Margaret, last one.
Just along those lines, in Job, you have Satan, you know, asking God to vassal Job, and then at the end of the book, it talks about his neighbors came over and comforted him for all the nastiness that God has brought upon him. So, Job at least doesn't see any distinction. Satan did it, God did it.
Okay, thanks.